I'd like to go ahead and reconvene the January 27th, 2009 Senate Finance Committee meeting, and we will adjourn the January 27th meeting at 10:15 Senate time on the 28th. Ready? Okay. To go ahead and bring the Senate Finance Committee January 28th, 2009, 10:16 a.m. to order. I'd like to welcome Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Elton, Senator Huggins, and Senator Thomas. We have one presentation today from the Alaska Mental Health, and we're going to have the next meeting on Friday the 30th at 9 a.m. For an overview of the cruise ship head tax from the Department of Revenue. Again, that's Friday. We're going to adjourn promptly at 5 to 11 for the floor. So if I could ask the committee members to go ahead and hold their questions for Mr. Jesse until he is finished. He's going to try to give us about 10 minutes for questions. It would be appreciated. Mr. Jesse, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent and who's with you. And good to see you too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I appreciate the time here today with the committee. With me is Lorraine Durr, the Vice Chair of the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Dr. Doolittle, the Chair of the Board, would like to have been here today, but he's back in Fairbanks recovering from some surgery. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Lorraine Durr.
Thanks. And thank you for allowing us to come today. I'm closing up here. See, how do I want to start here? The Alaska Mental Health Trust is probably one of the most important media or committees to be on in the state, and I really appreciate being there and being on the board. And with me today are some of the other trust members. Tim, I don't know if Tim Search is here today. He's on the trust. Paula Easley is here. Larry Noreen is in Anchorage. Tom Hawkins is a member of the trust. He's in Anchorage also, and he is just going off of the board in March. He's been on it since its inception in 1994. So he's the last remaining trust member from when the trust was settled. And then Mary Jane Michaels and Dan Hoffman were just appointed yesterday. Mary Jane is from Anchorage, and Dan is the retiring police chief in Fairbanks. So they're coming on. So we'll have a full complement of trustees starting in March. So it's going to be nice to have everyone there. And then also today, I'd just like to point out some of the staff members that are here. We often think that Jeff runs the trust by himself, but he couldn't. I mean, and Jeff Jesse is the trust because he's been there from time immemorial. But also with him today are Bill Herman, who's a senior program officer. Steve Williams is a program officer. Katie Baldwin-Johnson, Mike Baldwin, Luke Lind, and then Jeff's second in command is Delisa Culpepper. And so she's your right hand.
Absolutely.
And anyway, those are the staff people that help run the trust. So we're glad to have them here. The trust beneficiaries are people with mental illness, people with developmental disabilities, people with chronic alcoholism, and then people with Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia. And those groups advise us. The boards of those groups advise us. And kind of an overview of the whole mental health picture in state is the Alaska scorecard. And Jeff, if you want to just review the scorecard, you have that in your packets, a snapshot view of the status of mental health.
Yes, we have worked very hard on this. One of our statutory obligations to you is to present to you a status of the mental health condition of the state of Alaska. So we've been working very closely with the Department of Health and Social Services to develop this scorecard so that you can see at a glance how we're doing on some key indicators of Alaska's mental health. So I'll let you kind of go through this. This is very helpful to us. It's not so much a measure of the performance of the program as it is a status of the condition of Alaska's mental health. And you can see at the bottom the prevalence estimates of trust beneficiaries in the state. And they total over 70,000 individuals. And that, of course, doesn't include prevention and other issues. So we'll continue to use this scorecard. One of the nice things about this is if you go to the website at Health and Social Services, you can actually drill down, or your staff can drill down in each of these areas and get more information about what actually is the data that we have that demonstrates what our status is. So we're very excited about this and intend to continue to improve it as a tool for all of us to use in the future.
So, and as I said, as we help beneficiaries throughout the state, we are advised by several groups. We have the Alaska Mental Health Board. We've got the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We've got the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed. We've got the Alaska Commission of Aging. And those four groups were detailed in the law as advisory groups, and they each have boards that meet and bring their recommendations forward. Then we also have the Commissioners of Health and Social Services, the Commissioner of Corrections, Natural Resources, and the Department of Revenue, who come to our meetings and give us advice from their departments. Then we also have the Alaska Brain Injury Network and the Suicide Prevention Council, who we work in concert with. As you are addressing, we have had to address also this year with funding shortfall. Ordinarily, we take 4.25% of our investment of the money that is in the trust, and it is apportioned out so that we can then give it out to grants during the year. When we put our budget together in September, there was $26 million that we were looking at and put into our budget for next year. By the 1st of January, that was down to $21 million. So like everyone else, we're looking at budget adjustments. We met the second week in January, and we did that. We reduced our budget to $21 million. So while our endowment has dropped about $100 million in value, that translates to about a $5 million drop in what we have available to spend for next year. So like everyone else, we're dealing with that, and as chair of the finance committee, we deal with it frequently. So we have about $21.8 million that we're going to be that will be in our budget for next year. And so with that, Jeff, I'll turn it over to you then for the rest of the overview.
Now, you have the slide presentation in your packets, but let me first go over our 2010 legislative priorities. One of our top priorities is the reauthorization of the Adult Dental Medicaid program. As you know, a few years ago, we worked with the legislature to expand the dental program to include preventive and restorative services. And one of the things that we did in cooperation with the legislature is we put some budgetary fences around that. We set a cap on the amount that each individual claimant could use in a given fiscal year, and we set an overall budget target for the program. Well, I'm happy to report that the Department of Health and Social Services has done an excellent job at managing that program, keeping it in the box, so that it met the budgetary expectations of the legislature, and we are encouraged that will help support the reauthorization of the dental expansion of Medicaid bill that will be coming through the legislature this year. It's a tremendous benefit to all of our beneficiaries. In addition, we are supportive of establishing a regular and periodic schedule for rate reviews for home and community-based services. You've heard me talk about this before. With hospitals and nursing homes, our most expensive and restrictive services in the state, by statute, we have a periodic rate review to ensure that they're able to operate in the black and continue to provide services. But we do not provide that type of rate review for our community-based services. Those are the services that prevent people from getting to the point where they need more expensive out-of-home, out-of-community care. And we think it's poor public policy and something that the legislature should address so that we ensure that we meet people's needs as early as possible in the most cost-efficient way and the most effective way possible. In addition, we're requesting that you look favorably on funding the 10-year plan to reduce homelessness. We've been here before talking about the housing trust. You'll see in a few minutes the results that we've got from using those strategies that we've talked to you about before. Again, the Council on the Homeless, led by Dan Fowsky from AHFC, has met in the interim and has developed a 10-year plan to significantly reduce homelessness in the state. And if you look at your scorecard on line 16, you'll see that Alaska's rate of chronic homelessness per 100,000 is far more than twice the national rate. And if you wonder why that might be the case, if you look down on line 19, you'll see that it takes 85% of a minimum wage income to afford two-bedroom housing. For many of our beneficiaries, near minimum wage jobs is really what, in the long term, is realistic to expect. But if they have to pay 85% of that income just to be housed, they're not economically viable. That is not good public policy, because that continues to push them into more dependence on governmental support and programs. And so again, we'll be looking at supporting the first year increments in that 10-year plan to reduce homelessness, which is, by the way, in the governor's budget. And then finally, funding community coordinated transportation systems. Our beneficiaries are very dependent upon good transportation in order to get to jobs, get to treatment, get to schools. But in the past, virtually every nonprofit wanted to have their own van that often sat idle for most of the day. We can't afford that. So we've been working closely with you and Department of Transportation and leveraging federal funds and state funds and trust funds to develop coordinated transportation systems in communities so that vans are shared and the allocation of that resource is coordinated and made efficient and effective. And we need to continue those efforts in the coming year. You know, the trustees do not just throw money at these problems. We have a very deliberate process of approaching resolving mental health issues in the state. First, of course, is identifying the need. Second is to collaborate with a wide range of stakeholders, whether they be governmental agencies, advisory groups, our boards, nonprofits, service providers, the philanthropic sector, the Rasmussen Foundation is a longtime partner of the trust. The private sector, housing developers, and others. We pull everyone to the table to work on these issues together and then develop specific outcome goals and measures and strategies that we can track over time in order to determine if we're actually making the types of investments and asking you to make the types of investments that will be most effective in dealing with these issues. And so I have some very exciting results to share with you as we go through our presentation, but I want you to know it's the result of pulling folks together and taking a strategic view of how to address these issues. We have, as you probably remember, five focus areas: bring the kids home, housing, disability justice, workforce development, and beneficiary projects. Bring the kids home, we've been here before to talk about this. In FY 2006, throughout the year, 743 Alaska children, about 439 at any one time, were out of state at psychiatric residential treatment facilities at a cost to the state of nearly $40 million. We started working with the Murkowski administration and the legislature. We carried that work on into the Palin administration. Again, we gathered our partners. We developed a strategic plan of how to address this issue. And what we came to was the need to reinvest these out-of-state expenditures into a constellation of in-state services. And so as you can see on page 10, this is a record and a projection of that reinvestment. You can see in FY05 the heavy reliance on out-of-state RPTCs. and in-state RPTCs and very little community investment. Over the next 3 years, and those first 4 years are actuals through FY08, you can see the reinvestment from those out-of-state Medicaid dollars going into community-based programs within the state of Alaska. And if you look at the red numbers at the bottom, you can see that we've been able to contain the overall cost of serving this population. Well, what kind of results have we gotten? From April of 2006, when we had a high water mark of 429 kids in out-of-state residential treatment facilities, on the first of December 29th of 08, we were down to 175. And as of yesterday, we were down to 168. These are proven results. By reinvesting in a strategic manner dollars that you would have to have spent, and by the way, we're increasing exponentially for those of you that remember where we started with this effort, by reinvesting those into the community. And again, not by simply dumping these kids back on their families and communities, but by developing a system of individualized services, group homes, foster homes, working closely with our rural community and tribal providers to develop their capacity at the tribal health corporation level to address this problem. We're not done yet. When you look at the 2010 budget, you'll see some additional reinvestment of these savings. And I will say that this was a great dialogue with the Office of Management and Budget. When we were going through exercises with OMB for the 2010 budget, and they were looking skeptically at these increments for Bring the Kids Home, we were able, in conjunction with Bill Hogan at the Department of Health and Social Services, to say, well, if we're going to get charged with these increments, we should get credit for the $3.8 million Medicaid reduction that's the result of bringing these kids and serving these kids in-state, rather than spending that $3.8 million in out-of-state placements. And I'm pleased to say that that met with a receptive attitude at OMB, and these increments are in the governor's budget. Housing, of course, is an area that we've worked very hard on for a number of years. As you know, there are 3,500 Alaskans that are homeless on any given night. Families with children are one of the fastest growing segments of the homeless population. And again, from the scorecard, you can see that that's a combination of the effects of the cost of housing, and in the case of our beneficiaries, it's the fact that they often need support services. This is why dealing with the homeless problem is different than just dealing with low-income housing. For our beneficiaries and many others, just putting them in a house or an apartment is not sufficient. They have difficulty not only making ends meet, but in strategizing how to develop their financial security. Most of them are not banked. They get their minimum wage check or their public benefits check in their pocket. They convert it to cash, often at one of these check cashing entities that takes a percentage. And what would happen to any of us if we got our check in cash every payday? It would be very difficult for us to manage our financial future, even with the incomes that we have. And it's doubly difficult for our beneficiaries, which is why our approach to housing has been to follow the national trend towards housing first and the development of housing trust models to combine support services with housing to ensure not only that people that are at risk or are chronically homeless get housing, but that they keep housing, and that housing becomes the springboard to employment, to education, and to a secure financial future that takes them out of a pattern of dependency on governmental programs. One of the pilots that we've utilized to demonstrate the effectiveness of this is the Bridge Home Pilot Program. Now, this is funded entirely from the trust, and what we did is combine AHFC resources with Department of Health and Social Services resources and brought people that had been in a pattern of going in and out of corrections, in and out of API, into a housing, a stable housing environment with support services. And what results did we get? Well, as you can see, we reduced admits to API by 38%. We reduced admits to corrections by 48%. We reduced the days spent in the 2 years before they were in this program to the 2 years they were in the program. So it's apples to apples. We've reduced their days in API by 32%, and an amazing reduction in the days in the Department of Corrections by 68%. Again, these are proven results by using evidence-based strategic intervention strategies. And when you look at funding the 10-year plan for the reduction of homelessness, this is the type of strategy that we're proposing that we use, and we believe these are the types of results that we can get. And as you start to look in your subcommittees at the ever-growing budgets of corrections and the court system and public safety, realize that this population is the one that continues to cycle back into the criminal justice system, and you'll see in a few minutes another manifestation of that exact phenomenon and what we believe we can do to turn the curve. Again, it's a proven model. You can see the types of services that are included. There are 600 housing trusts operating across the country. Even in communities like Los Angeles and New York, they have made dramatic inroads in the homeless population by using these strategies, and we can too. Again, in 2010, you'll see this reflected in the governor's budget, and we'll continue to work on implementing these models and expanding them around the state. Disability justice is another area that we've spent a lot of effort on. You know, we've always known that the Department of Corrections was our single largest mental health provider. What we didn't know is exactly how many beneficiaries really were in the Department of Corrections. So a couple of years ago, we started a study that's just been completed to actually look at how many beneficiaries are there in the Department of Corrections. Even we were surprised to find that 42% of the inmates in the Department of Corrections are trust beneficiaries. And if you add the number of inmates whose criminal behavior was linked to alcohol in some way, that figure goes over 90%. Those of you that were here last year and were aware of Senator French's Justice Forum, where we were able to look at evidence-based practices that are in use around the state, and frankly, in some cases here in Alaska, know that it is clearly possible for us to develop a strategy, as we did with Bring the Kids Home, to reinvest the dollars that we would otherwise spend and will spend if we do nothing on the Department of Corrections and the court systems over time. And remember, the Department of Corrections came in with a $1 billion 10-year projection. We can turn that curve by investing in a portfolio of evidence-based practices to keep people like our beneficiaries from getting into corrections, keeping them from coming back into corrections, and getting them stabilized in the community. Hopefully you're beginning to see how things like the 10-year plan to end homelessness works with these other programs to start to turn the curve on some of these very high cost centers in the state budget. And of course, that's not even going into the impact on OCS of child abuse and spousal abuse and all the other manifestations of particularly substance abuse. Here you can see the comparison distribution of beneficiaries in the Department of Corrections and what a major impact that is on our system. And again, our approach to this has been strategic, looking at how to link up people that have been coming through corrections with community mental health and substance abuse treatment, early screening to identify beneficiaries as soon as they enter the criminal justice system so we can begin a discharge plan, if you will, from that point forward, looking at appropriate diversions such as mental health court and wellness court, which again we have rigorously evaluated and have demonstrated the results. As you remember, a couple of years ago, we were even successful in convincing Senator Green that this was such an effective program that we were able to develop one in the Valley, and you'll see in a minute what the results have been of that. If you look at the Anchorage Mental Health Court on page 22, you can see that we've reduced misdemeanors by 17%. We've reduced new felonies by 16%. And there's Senator Green's Palmer Mental Health Court, again, getting significant outcomes. And one of the things I said to Senator Green when we agreed to go out into the valley and with trust funds start the mental health court in the valley. If she would agree to pick up the Anchorage Mental Health Court with general funds. And I know there are issues around replacing trust funds with general funds, but when we convinced her to do that, she looked me in the eye and she said, now you'll be coming back here and asking me to put general funds into this Palmer Mental Health Court at some point, won't you? And I looked right back at her and I said, you bet we will. But the difference is, when we come back, you'll know what the results of that investment are. And if you deem them worthy of investment, then you'll make that investment. And if you feel it's not effective enough to warrant that investment, then you don't need to fund it. And we'll make decisions on our part as to how we then go on and prioritize these programs. Again, you'll see ahead in 2010, continuing to work on these proven evidence-based practices in the mental health court field. You'll see the seed money for the Fairbanks Juvenile Mental Health Court coming out of trust funding, continuing to expand. One thing I do want to point out to you is about on the fourth line down, you'll see treatment funding for therapeutic court participants, $500,000 in GFMH. One of the biggest barriers right now to continuing to develop mental health and wellness courts and getting the benefits of their proven effectiveness is the lack of community-based mental health and substance abuse treatment. And it is against our better judgment, frankly, that we are recommending a specific increment to the court system for them to purchase these services. We would prefer to have a robust community system that could respond to the needs of the mental health and wellness courts. But right now, our community-based system is not capable of providing that access to the mental health court participants. And what we don't want to do is to get into a situation which we are rapidly approaching, where the only way you can get timely treatment is to commit a crime and to get into the criminal justice system. That is not the direction that we need to take. Workforce development is an area that we've gotten into because, as we've realized across all of our beneficiary groups, and services, if you don't have a qualified workforce that you can retain over time, all of the good intentions and funding by the legislature and the trust are to no avail. And so we've worked very hard with the university, Department of Labor, and others to identify ways to recruit, retain, and train people to work in these programs. We've now been going into more of the public arena, trying to encourage our young people in high school and others to realize that not only is the health field one of the best opportunities for employment and career building, but mental health is an area that offers a lot of opportunities for folks. This, I think, is particularly important in rural Alaska. You know, there are such a shortage of cash-paying jobs in those communities, but such an overabundance of problems. If we're able to train people up coming from smaller communities around the state and get them employed as behavioral health aides and village-based counselors and find ways, frankly, to pay for that through Medicaid and other funding sources, we can not only assist in developing the economies of those communities, but help address some of the underlying problems that those communities face as well. Again, ahead in 2010 on workforce, you'll see the loan repayment strategies for health professionals, our partnership with the University of Alaska, and developing psychiatric residency programs in the state and PhD psychologist internships. The Trust Beneficiary Initiative is one that's wholly funded by the Trust, and we are not asking for any general funds for this year. And I'll tell you what the premise is here. The premise is that it isn't always necessary for people to become dependent upon government programs to get in and maintain recovery. That in fact, beneficiaries and people who experience these disabilities can do a lot to support each other. And so what we're doing in this initiative is spending over $1 million a year in trust funds to support consumers to support themselves. And we fund a number of programs, peer-run alternatives to residential treatment, peer-to-peer support, drop-in centers and clubhouses, and community education and advocacy. We have over 27 beneficiary grantees since 2006, and one of the things that we're doing now is rigorously evaluating that program to see what results that we're going to get. Now, at some point, we do anticipate coming to you, showing you what those results are, and we believe that, peer-to-peer support needs to be and is a cost-effective component of a comprehensive mental health program for the state. And Senator, amazingly, I have finished exactly on time.
Right on time. We're running a little late today. We had an appointment set up with the administration at the last moment yesterday, so that's why we were delayed here in bringing the meeting to order. So I do apologize to the Mental Health Board, you know, for the tight time frame from the committee, but we thought it would be better to have you do your presentation than have everybody come back to town.
No, I appreciate it. This worked out great.
We have questions from the committee members. Senator Elton.
A question, and if it's easy, go ahead and answer it here. If not, feel free to get back to me or the committee through the chair. I was especially intrigued by the charts that you had on page 15 and page 22 of your presentation. And it's interesting to see the data that you collated presented in percentages. But I'm assuming you have made some assumptions, and you may be able to aggregate the data in a different way, which would reflect the savings that accrue to the state in public safety, corrections, courts, child support services. It would be interesting, I mean, because we think in dollars spent, it would be interesting to if you can aggregate the data in a way that shows dollars saved because of these percentage drops.
Absolutely, Senator Elton, through the chair. We can absolutely do that. When you look on page 15 and you look at a reduction of 2,200 bed days in corrections down to about 650, we can absolutely quantify what those bed days cost. It gets a little tricky when you start to try to add in the court system costs and the public safety costs, because those are a little more difficult to calculate, but we can definitely get you some hard numbers that come from the bed day costs, and then we can give you some idea of what some of the other costs may be. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation. My question is, since we're highlighting corrections in this case, what is your operational relationship with the Department of Corrections?
It's significantly improved, in fact, dramatically improved under the current commissioner. Commissioner Schmidt gets it. I mean, there's no other way to say it. When he looks at the projected growth in his department, he's come to us and to his fellow commissioner, Bill Hogan, and said, look, I can only do what I can do while they're with me. The problem is they keep coming back, and I can't, I'm not in control of that. You are. And so we've been working very closely with the Department of Corrections, and in fact, we've been working with them very closely on the Criminal Justice Working Group, which is co-chaired by the Lieutenant Governor and Justice Carpinetti. And I believe later in the session you'll be seeing some recommendations from that group on how to address these issues. So, you know, frankly, going back quite a while, I think this is the best relationship we've had with the Department of Corrections in a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, thank you for your presentation. The rate review bill, one of your priorities is Senate Bill 32. And I'd like to ask for your help and the help of all supporting agencies and organizations for letters of support for the legislation. So if you can help me get the word out about that needed for the bill packets, that would be great.
Senator Ellis, through the chair, we'd be happy to help.
Thank you.
Do we have any closing questions before we go to the floor? Well, thank you. Thank you for coming, Senate Finance, today. Again, on Friday, January 30th, 9 a.m., cruise ship head tax review from the Department of Revenue. Meeting adjourned.